Just before the explosion came, Susan Day, standing in a hot white spotlight at the front of the Civic Center, and now living through the last few seconds of her fabulous, provocative life, was saying, "I haven't come to Derry to heal you, hector you, or to incite you, but to mourn with you. This is a situation which has passed far beyond political considerations. There's no right in violence, nor refuge in self-righteousness. I am here to ask that you put your positions and your rhetoric aside and help each other find a way to help each other. To turn away from the attractions of..." The high windows lining the south side of the auditorium suddenly lit up with a brilliant white glare and then blew inward. The Cherokee missed the Hoodsy wagon, but that didn't save it. The plane took one final half turn in the air and then screwed itself into the parking lot, about 25 feet from the fence where, earlier that day, Lois had paused to yank up her troublesome half-slip. The wings snapped off. The cockpit made a quick and violent journey back through the passenger section. The fuselage blew out with the fury of a bottle of champagne in a microwave oven. Glass flew. The tail bent over the Cherokee's body like the stinger of a dying scorpion, and impaled itself in the roof of a Dodge van with the words, "Protect Women's Right to Choose," stenciled on the side. There was a bright and bitter crunch clang that sounded like a dropped pile of scrap iron. "Holy shit," one of the cops posted on the edge of the parking lot began. And then the C4 inside the cardboard box flew free like a big gray glob of phlegm and struck the remains of the instrument panel, where several hot wires rammed into it like hypo needles. The plastique exploded with an ear-crunching thud, flash-frying the Bassey Park racetrack and turning the parking lot into a hurricane of white light and shrapnel. John Lydecker, who'd been standing under the Civic Center's cement canopy and talking to a state cop, was thrown through one of the open doors and all the way across the lobby. He struck the far wall and fell unconscious into the shattered glass from the harness racing trophy case. At that, he was luckier than the man with whom he'd been standing. The state cop was thrown into the post between two of the open doors and chopped in half. The ranks of cars actually shielded the Civic Center from the worst of the hammering concussive blow, but that blessing would only be counted later. Inside, over 2,000 people at first sat stunned, unsure of what they should do, and even more unsure of what most of them had just seen. America's most famous feminist decapitated by a jagged chunk of flying glass. Her head went flying into the sixth row like some strange white bowling ball with a blonde wig pasted on it. They didn't erupt into panic until the lights went out. 71 people were killed in the trampling, panicked rush to the exits. And the next day is Derry News would trumpet the event with a 48-point scare headline, calling it a terrible tragedy. Ralph Roberts could have told them that, all things considered, they had gotten off lucky. Very lucky indeed. Halfway up the north balcony, a woman named Sonia Danville, a woman with the bruises of the last beating any man would ever give her, still fading from her face, sat with her arms around the shoulders of her son, Patrick. Patrick's McDonald's poster, showing Ronald and Mayor McCheese and the Hamburglar dancing the boot scootin' boogie just outside a drive-through window, was on his lap. But he had hardly done more than color the golden arches before turning the poster over to the blank side. It wasn't that he had lost interest. It was just that he'd had an idea for a picture of his own, and it had come, as such ideas often did to him, with the force of a compulsion. He had spent most of the day thinking about what had happened in the cellar at High Ridge. The smoke, the heat, the frightened women, and the two angels that had come to save him. But his splendid idea banished these disturbing thoughts, and he fell to work with silent enthusiasm. Soon Patrick felt almost as if he were living in the world he was drawing with his Crayolas. He was an amazingly competent artist already, only 4 years old or not. My little genius, Sonia sometimes called him, and his picture was much better than the color-it-in poster on the other side of the sheet. What he had managed before the lights went out was work a gifted first-year art student might have been proud of. In the middle of the poster sheet, a tower of dark, soot-colored stone rose into a blue sky dotted with fat white clouds. Surrounding it was a field of roses, so red they almost seemed to clamor aloud. Standing off to one side was a man dressed in faded blue jeans. A pair of gun belts crossed his flat middle. A holster hung below each hip. At the very top of the tower, a man in a red robe was looking down at the gunfighter with an expression of mingled hate and fear. His hands, which were curled over the parapet, also appeared to be red. Sonia had been mesmerized by the presence of Susan Day, who was sitting behind the lectern and listening to her introduction. But she had happened to glance down at her son's picture just before the introduction ended. She'd known for 2 years that Patrick was what the child psychologists called a prodigy, and she sometimes told herself she had gotten used to his sophisticated drawings and the Play-Doh sculptures he called the Clay family. Perhaps she even had, to some degree, but this particular picture gave her a strange deep chill that she could not entirely dismiss as emotional fallout from her long and stressful day. "Who's that?" she asked, tapping the tiny figure peering jealously down from the top of the dark tower.
"Him's the Red King," Patrick said.
"Oh, the Red King, I see.
And who's this man with the guns?"
As he opened his mouth to answer, Roberta Harper, the woman at the podium, lifted her left arm, there was a black mourning band on it, toward the woman sitting behind her. "My friends, Miss Susan Day," she cried, and Patrick Danville's answer to his mother's second question was lost in the rising storm of applause.
"Him's name is Roland, Mama. I dream about him sometimes. Him's a king, too."
Now the two of them sat in the dark with their ears ringing, and two thoughts ran through Sonia's mind like rats chasing each other on a treadmill. "Won't this day ever end? I knew I shouldn't have brought him. Won't this day ever end? I knew I shouldn't have brought him. Won't this day?"
"Mommy, you're scrunching my picture," Patrick said.
He sounded a little out of breath, and Sonia realized she must be scrunching him, too. She eased up a little. A tattered skein of screams, shouts, and babbled questions came from the dark pit below them, where the people rich enough to pony up $15 donations had been seated in folding chairs. A rough howl of pain cut through this babble, making Sonia jump in her seat. The thudding crump which had followed the initial explosion had pressed in painfully on their ears and shaken the building. The blasts, which were still going on, cars exploding like firecrackers in the parking lot, sounded small and inconsequential in comparison. But Sonia felt Patrick flinch against her with each one.
"Stay calm, Pat," she told him. "Something bad's happened, but I think it happened outside."
Because her eyes had been drawn to the bright glare in the windows, Sonia had mercifully missed seeing her heroine's head leaving her shoulders, but she knew that somehow lightning had struck in the same place.
"Shouldn't have brought him. Shouldn't have brought him."
And that at least some of the people below them were panicking. If she panicked, she and young Rembrandt were going to be in serious trouble. "But I'm not going to. I didn't get out of that death box this morning just to panic now. I'll be goddamned if I will." She reached down and took one of Patrick's hands, the one that wasn't clutching his picture. It was very cold.
"Do you think the angels will come to save us again, Mama?"
he asked in a voice that quivered slightly.
"Nah," she said. "I think this time we'd better do it ourselves. But we can do that. I mean, we're all right now, aren't we?"
"Yes,"
he said, but then slumped against her. She had a terrible moment when she was sure he had fainted and she'd have to carry him from the Civic Center in her arms. But then he straightened up again.
"My books was on the floor," he said. I didn't want to leave without my books, especially the one about the boy who can't take off his hat. Are we leaving, Mama?"
"Yes, as soon as people stop running around. There'll be lights in the halls, ones that run on batteries, even though the ones in here are out. When I say we're going to get up and walk up the steps to the door, I'm not going to carry you, but I'm going to walk right behind you with both my hands on your shoulders. Do you understand, Pat?
Yes, Mama.
No questions, no blubbering, just his books thrust into her hands for safekeeping. He held on to the picture himself. She gave him a quick hug and kissed his cheek. They waited in their seats 5 minutes by her slow count to 300. She sensed that most of their immediate neighbors were gone before she got to 150, but she made herself wait. She could now see a little, enough for her to believe that something was burning fiercely outside, but on the far side of the building. That was very lucky. She could hear the warbled wail of approaching police cars, ambulances, and fire trucks. Sonia got to her feet. Come on, keep right in front of me. Pat Danville stepped into the aisle with his mother's hands pressed firmly down on his shoulders. He led her up the stairs toward the dim yellow lights which marked the north balcony corridor, stopping only once as the dark shape of a running man hurtled toward them. His mother's hands tightened on his shoulders as she yanked him aside.
Goddamn right to lifers, the running man cried. Fucking self-righteous turds! I'd like to kill them all!
Then he was gone, and Pat began walking up the stairs again. She felt a calmness in him now, a scented lack of fear that touched her heart with love, and with some queer darkness as well. He was so different, her son, so special. But the world did not love people like that. The world tried to root them out like tares from a garden. They emerged at last into the corridor. A few deeply shocked people wandered back and forth, eyes dazed and mouths agape, like zombies in a horror movie. Sonia hardly glanced at them, just got Pat moving toward the stairs. 3 minutes later, they exited into the fire-shot night, perfectly unscathed, and upon all the levels of the universe, matters both random and purposeful resumed their ordained courses. Worlds which had trembled for a moment in their orbits now steadied. And in one of those worlds, in a desert that was the apotheosis of all deserts, a man named Roland turned over in his bedroll and slept easily once again beneath the alien constellations. Across town in Strawford Park, the door of the Porto San marked Men blew open. Lois Chass and Ralph Roberts came flying out backward in a haze of smoke, clutching each other. From within came the sound of the Cherokee hitting and then the plastique exploding. There was a flash of white light, and the toilet's blue walls bulged outward, as if some giant had hammered them with his fists. A second later, they heard the explosion all over again. This time it came rolling across the open air. The second version was fainter, but somehow more real. Lois's feet stuttered and she thumped to the grass of the lower hillside with a cry, which was partly relief. Ralph landed beside her, then pushed himself up to a sitting position. He stared unbelievingly at the civic center, where a fist of fire was now clenched on the horizon. A purple lump, the size of a doorknob, was rising on his forehead, where Ed had hit him. His left side still throbbed, but he thought maybe the ribs in there were only sprung, not broken. Lois, are you all right? She looked at him uncomprehendingly for a moment, then began to feel at her face and neck and shoulders. There was something so perfectly, sweetly our Lois about this examination that Ralph laughed. He couldn't help it. Lois smiled tentatively back at him. I think I'm fine. In fact, I'm quite sure I am. What were you doing there? You could have been killed. Lois, appearing somewhat rejuvenated, Ralph guessed that the handy wino had had something to do with that, looked him in the eye. I may be old-fashioned, Ralph, but if you think I'm going to spend the next 20 years or so fainting and fluttering like the heroine's best friend in those Regency romances my friend Minna's always reading, you better pick another woman to chum around with. He gaped for a moment, then pulled her to her feet and hugged her. Lois hugged back. She was incredibly warm, incredibly there. Ralph reflected for a moment on the similarities between loneliness and insomnia, how they were both insidious, cumulative, and divisive, the friends of despair and the enemies of love. And then he pushed those thoughts aside and kissed her. Clotho and Lachesis, who had been standing at the top of the hill and looking as anxious as workmen who have wagered their Christmas bonuses on a prize-fight underdog, now rushed down to where Ralph and Lois stood with their foreheads once more pressed together, looking into each other's eyes like love-struck teenagers. From the far side of the barrens, the sound of sirens rose like voices heard in uneasy dreams. The pillar of fire which marked the grave of Ed Deepnose's obsession was now too bright to look at without squinting. Ralph could hear the faint sound of cars exploding, and he thought of his car, sitting abandoned somewhere out in the Willywags. He decided that was okay. He was too old to drive.
Clotho, are you both all right?
Ralph, we're fine. Lois reeled me in. She saved my life. Lachesis.
Yes, we saw her go in. It was very brave.
Also very perplexing, right, Mr. L? Ralph thought. You saw it and you admire it. But I don't think you have any idea of how or why she could bring herself to do it. I think that, to you and your friend, the concept of rescue must seem almost as foreign as the idea of love. For the first time, Ralph felt a kind of pity for the little bald doctors, and understood the central irony of their lives. They were aware that the short-timers whose existences they had been sent to prune lived powerful inner lives, but they did not in the least comprehend the reality of those lives, the emotions which drove them, or the actions, sometimes noble, sometimes foolish, which resulted. Mr. C. and Mr. L. had studied their short-time charges as certain rich but timid Englishmen had studied the maps brought back by the explorers of the Victorian age. Explorers who had in many cases been funded by these same rich but timid men. With their clipped nails and soft fingers, the philanthropists had traced paper rivers upon which they would never ride and paper jungles through which they would never safari. They lived in fearful perplexity and passed it off as imagination. Clotho and Lachesis had drafted them, and had used them with a certain crude effectiveness, but they understood neither the joy of risk nor the sorrow of loss. The best they had been able to manage in the way of emotion was a nagging fear that Ralph and Lois would try to take on the Crimson King's pet research chemist directly and be swatted like elderly flies for their pains. The little bald doctors lived long lives, but Ralph suspected that, brilliant dragonfly auras notwithstanding, they were gray lives. He looked at their unlined, oddly childish faces from the safe haven of Lois's arms and remembered how terrified of them he had been when he had first seen them coming out of May Locker's house in the early hours of the morning. Terror, he had since discovered, could not survive mere acquaintanceship, let alone knowledge, and now he had some of both. Clotho and Lachesis returned his gaze with an uneasiness Ralph found he had absolutely no urge to allay. It seemed very right to him, somehow, that they should feel the way they were feeling. Ralph, yes, she's very brave, and I love her very much, and I think we'll make each other very happy until... He broke off, and Lois stirred in his arms. He realized with a mixture of amusement and relief that she'd been half asleep.
Until what, Ralph?
Until you name it. I guess that there's always an until when you're a short-timer, and maybe that's okay.
Lachesis.
Well, I guess this is goodbye.
Ralph grinned in spite of himself, reminded of the Lone Ranger radio program, where almost every episode had ended with some version of that line. He reached out toward Lachesis and was sourly amused to see the little man recoil from him.
Ralph. Wait a minute. Let's not be so hasty, fellas.
Clotho, with a tinge of apprehension.
Is something wrong?
I don't think so. But after getting popped in the head, popped in the ribs, and then damn near roasted alive,
I think I have a right to make sure that it's really over. Is it? Is your boy safe?
Clotho smiling and clearly relieved.
Yes, can't you feel it? 18 years from now, just before his death, the boy is going to save the lives of 2 men who would otherwise die. And one of those men must not die if the balance between the random and the purpose is to be maintained.
Lois, never mind all that. I just want to know if we can go back to being regular short-timers again.
Lachesis, not only can, Lois, but must. If you and Ralph were to stay up here much longer, you wouldn't be able to go back down.
Ralph felt Lois press more tightly against him. I wouldn't like that.
Clotho and Lachesis turned toward each other, and a subtle, perplexed glance.
How could anybody not like it up here? Their eyes asked.
Passed between them before they turned back to Ralph and Lois.
Lachesis.
We really must be going. I'm sorry, but...
Ralph. Hold on, neighbors. You're not going anywhere yet.
They looked at him apprehensively, while Ralph slowly pushed up the sleeve of his sweater. The cuff was now stiff with some fluid, perhaps catfish ichor, that he found he did not want to think about, and showed them the white, knotted line of scar on his forearm.
Put away the constipated looks, guys. I just want to remind you that you gave me your word. Don't forget that part of it.
Clotho, with obvious relief.
You can depend on it, Ralph. What was your weapon is now our bond. The promise will not be forgotten.
Ralph was beginning to believe it really was over, and crazy as it seemed, part of him regretted it. Now it was real life, life as it went on the floors below this level, that seemed almost like a mirage, and he understood what Lachesis had meant when he told him that they would never be able to return to their normal lives if they stayed up here much longer.
Lachesis,
we really must go. Fare you well, Ralph and Lois. We will never forget the service you have rendered us.
Ralph, did we ever have a choice? Did we really?
Lachesis, very softly.
We told you so, didn't we? For short-timers, there is always a choice. We find that frightening, but we also find it beautiful.
Ralph, say, do you fellows ever shake hands?
Clotho and Lachesis glanced at each other, startled, and Ralph sensed some quick dialogue flashing between them in a kind of telepathic shorthand. When they looked back at Ralph, they wore identical nervous smiles, the smiles of teenage boys who have decided that if they can't find enough courage to ride the big roller coaster at the amusement park this summer, they will never truly be men.
Clotho,
we have observed this custom many times, of course, but... No, we have never shaken hands.
Ralph looked at Lois and saw she was smiling, but he thought he saw a shimmer of tears in her eyes as well. He offered his hand to Lachesis first, because Mr. L. seemed marginally less jumpy than his colleague.
Put her there, Mr. L.
Lachesis looked at Ralph's hand for so long that Ralph began to think he wasn't going to be able to actually do it, although he clearly wanted to. Then, timidly, he put out his own small hand and allowed Ralph's larger one to close over it. There was a tingling vibration in Ralph's flesh as their auras first mingled, then merged. And in that merging, he saw a series of swift, beautiful silver patterns. They reminded him of the Japanese characters on Ed's scarf. He pumped Lachesis's hand twice, slowly and formally, then released it. Lachesis's look of apprehension had been replaced by a large, goony smile. He turned to his partner.
His force is almost completely unguarded during this ceremony. I felt it. It's quite wonderful.
Clotho inched his own hand out to meet Ralph's, and in the instant before they touched, Mr. C. closed his eyes like a man expecting a painful injection. Lachesis, meanwhile, was shaking hands with Lois, and grinning like a vaudeville hoofer taking an encore. Clotho appeared to steel himself, then seized Ralph's hand. He flagged it once firmly. Ralph grinned.
Take her easy, Mr. C.
Clotho withdrew his hand. He seemed to be searching for the proper response.
Thank you, Ralph. I will take her any way I can get her. Correct?
Ralph burst out laughing. Clotho, now turning to shake hands with Lois, gave him a puzzled smile, and Ralph clapped him on the back. You got it right, Mr. C. Absolutely right. He slipped his arm around Lois and gave the little bald doctors a final curious look. I'll be seeing you fellas again, won't I?
Clotho.
Yes, Ralph.
Ralph. Well, that's fine. About 70 years from now would be good for me. Why don't you boys just put it down on your calendar?
They responded with the smiles of politicians, which didn't surprise him much. Ralph gave them a little bow, then put his arms around Lois's shoulders and watched as Mr. C and Mr. L walked slowly down the hill. Lachesis opened the door of the slightly warped portezan marked Men. Clotho stood in the open doorway of Women. Lachesis smiled and waved. Clotho lifted the long-bladed scissors in a queer sort of salute. Ralph and Lois waved back. The bald doctor stepped inside and closed the doors. Lois wiped her streaming eyes and turned to Ralph.
Is that it?
It is, isn't it?
Ralph nodded.
What do we do now?
He held out his arm.
May I see you home, madam?
Smiling, she clasped his forearm just below the elbow.
Thank you, sir. You may.
They left Strawford Park that way, returning to the short time level as they came out on Harris Avenue, slipping back down to the normal place in the scheme of things, with no fuss or bother, without, in fact, even being aware they were doing it until it was done. Derry groaned with panic and sweated with excitement. Sirens wailed, people shouted from second-story windows to friends on the sidewalks below, and on every street corner people had clustered to watch the fire on the other side of the valley. Ralph and Lois paid no attention to the tumult and hurrah. They walked slowly up Mile Hill, increasingly aware of their exhaustion. It seemed to come piling into them like softly thrown bags of sand. The pool of white light marking the Red Apple Store's parking lot seemed an impossible distance away, although Ralph knew it was only 3 blocks, and short ones at that. To make matters worse, the temperature had dropped a good 15 degrees since that morning. The wind was blowing hard, and neither of them was dressed for the weather. Ralph suspected this might be the leading edge of autumn's first big gale, and that in Derry, Indian summer was over. Faye Chapin, Don Veazey, and Stan Eberle came hurrying down the hill toward them, obviously bound for Strawford Park. The field glass's old door, sometimes used to watch planes taxi, land, and take off, were bouncing around Faye's neck. With Don, who was balding and heavyset, in the middle, their resemblance to a more famous trio was inescapable. The Three Stooges of the Apocalypse, Ralph thought, and grinned.
Ralph!
Faye exclaimed. He was breathing fast, almost panting. The wind blew his hair into his eyes, and he raked it back impatiently.
Goddamn Civic Center blew up. Someone bombed it from a light plane. We heard there's 1,000 people dead.
I heard about the same, Ralph agreed gravely. In fact, Lois and I have just been down at the park having a look. You can see straight across the valley from there, you know.
Christ, I know that. I've lived here all my damn life, haven't I? Where do you think we're going? Come on back with us.
Lois and I were just headed up to her house to see what they've got about it on TV. Maybe we'll join you later.
Okay, we... Jeepers creepers, Ralph. What did you do to your head?
For a moment, Ralph drew a blank. What had he done to his head? And then, in an instant of nightmarish recall, he saw Ed's snarling mouth and mad eyes.
Oh, no, don't!
Ed had screamed at him.
You'll spoil everything!
We were running to get a better look, and Ralph ran into a tree, Lois said. He's lucky not to be in the hospital. Don laughed at that, but in the half-distracted manner of a fellow who has bigger fish to fry. Faye wasn't paying attention to them at all. Stan Eberle was, however, and Stan didn't laugh. He was looking at them with close, puzzled curiosity.
Lois, he said.
What?
Did you know you've got a sneaker tied to your wrist?
She looked down at it. Ralph looked down at it. Then Lois looked up and gave Stan a dazzling, eye-frying smile. "Yes," she said. "It's an interesting look, isn't it? Sort of a life-sized charm bracelet."
"Yeah," Stan said. "Sure."
But he wasn't looking at the sneaker anymore. Now he was looking at Lois's face. Ralph wondered how in hell they were going to explain how they looked tomorrow, when there were no shadows between the streetlights to hide them. "Come on," Faye cried impatiently. "Let's get going." They hurried off. Stan gave them one last doubtful glance over his shoulder as they went. Ralph listened after them, almost expecting Don Vesey to give out a nyuk nyuk or two. "Boy, that sounded so dumb," Lois said. "But I had to say something, didn't I?"
"You did fine."
"Well, when I open my mouth, something always seems to fall out," she said. "It's one of my two great talents, the other being the ability to clean out an entire Whitman sampler during a two-hour TV movie." She untied Helen's sneaker and looked at it. "She's safe, isn't she?" "Yes," Ralph agreed and reached for the sneaker. As he did, he realized he already had something in his left hand. The fingers had been clamped down so long that they were creaky and reluctant to open. When they finally did, he saw the marks of his nails pressed into the flesh of his palm. The first thing he was aware of was that, while his own wedding ring was still in its accustomed place, Ed's was gone. It had seemed a perfect fit, but apparently it had slipped off his finger at some point during the last half an hour, just the same.
"Maybe not,"
a voice whispered, and Ralph was amused to realize that it wasn't Carolyn's this time. This time the voice in his head belonged to Bill McGovern. "Maybe it just disappeared. You know, poof." But he didn't think so. He had an idea that Ed's wedding band might have been invested with powers that hadn't necessarily died with Ed. The ring Bilbo Baggins had found and reluctantly given up to his grandson Frodo had had a way of going where it wanted to, and when. Perhaps Ed's ring wasn't all that different. Before he could consider this idea further, Lois traded Helen's sneaker for the thing in his hand, a small, stiff crumple of paper. She smoothed it out and looked at it. Her curiosity slowly changed to solemnity. "I remember this picture," she said. "The big one was on the mantel in their living room, in a fancy gold frame. It had pride of place." Ralph nodded. This must have been the one he carried in his wallet. It was taped to the instrument panel of the plane. Until I took it, he was beating me, and not even breathing hard while he did it. Grabbing his picture was all I could think of to do. When I did, his focus shifted from the Civic Center to them. The last thing I heard him say was, "Give them back! They're mine!" "And was he talking to you when he said it?" Ralph stuck the sneaker into his back pocket and shook his head. "Nope, don't think so." "Helen was at the Civic Center tonight, wasn't she?" "Yes." Ralph thought of how she had looked out at High Ridge, her pale face and smoke-reddened, watering eyes. "If they stop us now, they win," she'd said. "Don't you see that?" And now he did see. He took the picture from Lois's hand, crumpled it up again, and walked over to the litter basket which stood on the corner of Paris Avenue and Kossuth Lane. "We'll get another picture of them sometime. One we can keep on our own mantle. Something not quite so formal. This one, though, I don't want it." He tossed the little ball of paper at the litter basket, an easy shot, 2 feet at the most. But the wind picked that moment to gust, and the crumpled photo of Helen and Natalie, which had been taped above the altimeter of Ed's plane, flew away on its cold breath. The two of them watched it whirl up into the sky, almost hypnotized. It was Lois who looked away first. She glanced at Ralph with a trace of a smile curving her lips. "Did I hear a backhand proposal of marriage from you? Or am I just tired?" she asked. He opened his mouth to reply, and another gust of wind struck them. This one so hard it made them both wince their eyes shut. When he opened his, Lois had already started up the hill again. Anything's possible, Lois, he said. I know that now. 5 minutes later, Lois's key rattled in the lock of her front door. She led Ralph inside and shut it firmly behind them, closing out the windy, contentious night. He followed her into the living room and would have stopped there, but Lois never hesitated. Still holding his hand, not quite pulling him along, but perhaps meaning to do so if he began to lag, she showed him into her bedroom. He looked at her. Lois looked calmly back, and suddenly he felt the blink happen again. He watched her aura bloom around her like a gray rose. It was still diminished, but it was already coming back, re-knitting itself, healing itself. Lois, are you sure this is what you want? Of course it is. Do you think I was going to give you a pat on the head and send you home after all we've been through? Suddenly she smiled, a wickedly mischievous smile. Besides, Ralph, do you really feel like getting up to Dickens tonight? Tell me the truth. Better still, don't flatter me. He considered it, then laughed and drew her into his arms. Her mouth was sweet and slightly moist, like the skin of a ripe peach. That kiss seemed to tingle through his entire body, but the sensation was most concentrated in his mouth, where it felt almost like an electric shock. When their lips parted, he felt more excited than ever, but he also felt queerly drained. What if I say I do, Lois? What if I say I do want to get up to Dickens? She stood back and looked at him critically, as if trying to decide whether he meant what he said, or if it was just the usual male bluff and brag. At the same time, her hands went to the buttons of her dress. As she began to slip them free, Ralph noticed a wonderful thing. She looked younger again. Not 40 by any stretch of the imagination, but surely no more than 50, and a young 50. It had been the kiss, of course, and the really amusing thing was he didn't think she had the slightest idea that she had added a helping of Ralph to her earlier helping of Wino. And what was wrong with that? She finished her inspection, leaned forward, and kissed his cheek. I think that there'll be plenty of time for getting up to Dickens later, Ralph. Tonight's for sleeping. He supposed she was right. 5 minutes ago, he had been more than willing. He had always loved the act of physical love, and it had been a long time. For now, however, the spark was gone. Ralph didn't regret that in the least. He knew, after all, where it had gone. Okay, Lois, tonight's for sleeping. She went into the bathroom and the shower went on. A few minutes later, Ralph heard her brushing her teeth. It was nice to know she still had them. During the 10 minutes she was gone, he managed to do a certain amount of undressing, although his throbbing ribs made it slow work. He finally succeeded in wriggling McGovern's sweater off and pushing out of his shoes. His shirt came next, and he was fumbling ineffectually with a buckle of his belt when Lois came out with her hair tied back and her face shining. Ralph was stunned by her beauty and suddenly felt much too big and stupid, not to mention old, for his own good. She was wearing a long rose-colored silk nightgown, and he could smell the lotion she had used on her hands. It was a good smell. "Let me do that," she said, and had his belt unbuckled before he could say much, one way or the other. There was nothing erotic about it. She moved with the efficiency of a woman who had often helped her husband dress and undress during the last year of his life. "We're down again," he said. "This time I didn't even feel it happening." "I did, while I was in the shower. I was glad, actually. Trying to wash your hair through an aura is very distracting." The wind gusted outside, shaking the house and blowing a long, shivering note across the mouth of a downspout. They looked toward the window, and although he was back down on the short-time level, Ralph was suddenly sure that Lois was sharing his own thought. Atropos was out there somewhere right now, no doubt disappointed by the way things had gone, but by no means crushed. Bloody but unbowed, down but not out. From now on they can call him Old One Ear, Ralph thought and shivered. He imagined Atropos swinging erratically through the scared, excited populace of the city, like a rogue asteroid, peering and hiding, stealing souvenirs and slashing balloon strings, taking solace in his work, in other words. Ralph found it almost impossible to believe that he'd been sitting on top of that creature and slashing at him with his own scalpel not very long ago. How did I ever find the courage? He wondered. But he supposed he knew. The diamond earrings the little monster had been wearing had provided most of it. Did Atropos know those earrings had been his biggest mistake? Probably not. In his way, Doc Number 3 had proved even more ignorant of short-time motivations than Clotho and Lachesis. He turned to Lois and grasped her hands. I lost your earrings again. This time they're gone for good, I think. I'm sorry. Don't apologize. They were already lost, remember? And I'm not worried about Harold and Jan anymore, because now I've got a friend to help me when people don't treat me right, or when I just get scared, don't I? Yes, you most certainly do. She put her arms around him, hugged him tightly, and kissed him again. Lois had apparently not forgotten a single thing she'd ever learned about kissing, and it seemed to Ralph that she'd learned quite a lot. Go on and hop in the shower. He started to say that he thought he'd fall asleep the moment he got his head under a stream of warm water, but then she added something which changed his mind in a hurry. Don't take offense, but there's a funny smell on you, especially on your hands. It's the way my brother Vic used to smell after he'd spent the day cleaning fish. Ralph was in the shower 2 minutes later, and in soap suds up to his elbows. When he came out, Lois was buried beneath two puffy quilts. Only her face showed, and that was visible only from the nose up. Ralph crossed the room quickly, wearing only his undershorts and painfully conscious of his spindly legs and pot belly. He tossed back the covers and slid in quickly, gasping a little as the cool sheet slid along his warm skin. Lois slipped over to his side of the bed at once and put her arms around him. He put his face in her hair and let himself relax against her. It was very good being with Lois under the quilts, while the wind shrieked and gusted outside, sometimes hot enough to rattle the storm windows in their frames. It was, in fact, heaven. Thank God there's a man in my bed, Lois said sleepily. Thank God it's me, Ralph replied, and she laughed. Are your ribs okay? Do you want me to find you an aspirin? Nope. I'm sure they'll hurt again in the morning, but right now the hot water seems to have loosened everything up. The subject of what might or might not happen in the morning raised a question in his mind, one that had probably been waiting there all along. Lois? In his mind's eye, Ralph could see himself snapping awake in the dark, deeply tired but not at all sleepy. It was surely one of the world's cruelest paradoxes. As the numbers on the digital clock turned wearily over from 3:47 a.m. to 3:48, F. Scott Fitzgerald's Dark Night of the Soul, when every hour was long enough to build the Great Pyramid of Cheops. Do you think we'll sleep through? He asked her. Yes, she said unhesitatingly. I think we'll sleep just fine. A moment later, Lois was doing just that. Ralph stayed awake for perhaps 5 minutes longer, holding her in his arms, smelling the wonderful interwoven scents rising from her warm skin, luxuriating in the smooth, sensuous glide of the silk under his hands, marveling at where he was, even more than the events which had brought him here. He was filled with some deep and simple emotion, one he recognized but could not immediately name, perhaps because it had been gone from his life too long. The wind gusted and moaned outside, producing that hollow hooting sound over the top of the drain pipe again, like the world's biggest Nirvana boy blowing over the mouth of the world's biggest pop bottle. And it occurred to Ralph that maybe nothing in life was better than lying deep in a soft bed with a sleeping woman in your arms while the fall wind screamed outside your safe haven. Except there was something better, one thing at least, and that was the feeling of falling asleep, of going gently into that good night, slipping out into the currents of unknowing, the way a canoe slips away from a dock and slides into the current of a wide, slow river on a bright summer day. Of all the things which make up our short-time lives, sleep is surely the best, Ralph thought. The wind gusted again outside, the sound of it now seeming to come from a great distance. And as he felt the tug of that great river take him, he was finally able to identify the emotion he had been feeling ever since Lois had put her arms around him and fallen asleep as easily and as trustingly as a child. It went under many different names. Peace, serenity, fulfillment. But now, as the wind blew and Lois made some dark sound of sleeping contentment far back in her throat, it seemed to Ralph that it was one of those rare things which are known but essentially unnameable. A texture, an aura, perhaps a whole level of being in that column of existence. It was the smooth, russet color of rest. It was the silence which follows the completion of some arduous but necessary task. When the wind gusted again, bringing the sound of distant sirens with it, Ralph didn't hear it. He was asleep. Once he dreamed that he got up to use the bathroom, and he supposed that might not have been a dream. At another time, he dreamed that he and Lois made slow, sweet love, and that might not have been a dream either. If there were other dreams or moments of waking, he did not remember them. And this time, there was no snapping awake at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. They slept, sometimes apart, but mostly together, until just past 7 o'clock on Saturday evening, about 22 hours all told. Lois made them breakfast at sunset. Splendidly puffy waffles, bacon, home fries. While she cooked, Ralph tried to flex that muscle buried deep in his mind, to create that sensation of blink. He couldn't do it. When Lois tried, she was also unable, although Ralph could have sworn that just for a moment she flickered, and he could see the stove right through her. "Just as well," she said, bringing their plates to the table. "I suppose," Ralph agreed, but he still felt as he would have if he had lost the ring Carolyn had given him, instead of the one he had taken from Atropos. As if some small but essential object had gone rolling out of his life with a wink and a gleam. Following 2 more nights of sound, unbroken sleep, the auras had begun to fade as well. By the following week, they were gone, and Ralph began to wonder if perhaps the whole thing hadn't been some strange dream. He knew that wasn't so, but it became harder and harder to believe what he did know. There was the scar between the elbow and wrist of his right arm, of course. But he even began to wonder if that wasn't something he had acquired long ago. During those years of his life, when there had been no white in his hair, and he had still believed, deep in his heart, that old age was a myth, or a dream, or a thing reserved for people not as special as he was.